Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. And it's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I would like to introduce you to Joshua Holmes A. Court, who's doing a master's in classics under the supervision of Dr. Fabio Colavici. Welcome to Grad Chat, Joshua.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for coming in today. And before we dive into your research, I just wanted to ask a little bit about what brought you to Queen's, or like what attracted you to Queen's in the first place?
Yeah, so when I was doing my undergraduate degree, I'm actually from Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was doing my undergraduate degree at the University of Winnipeg. And by the end of it, I had thought, okay, I have enough university for me. I thought maybe I would like go to Australia and do like a program there where you like work for a year. And then my brother, who had done his graduate degree in music composition at York University, he encouraged me. He's like, well, you should just apply. Just apply.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied to a couple programs which I had thought were like very aligned with my specific research interests, and Queen's was one of them, and there was a couple others, which I won't name, but I got accepted into all of them, which I did not expect, because I guess I thought that I wasn't like good enough to be a graduate student. Even though my GPA was good and everything, I felt discouraged about it. And then when I applied, I got accepted, and I met with my supervisor, Dr. Fabio Colavici, and he was very encouraging, I guess, to me, and like was very interested in having me come to Queen's. And after meeting with him, I was like, yeah, I think this is the place I want to go. And the city is lovely as well. Kingston is very nice.
Oh, well, I'm glad you chose here, and I'm glad it was a good fit. No, it's nice to have a good first impression and a supportive supervisor, right? That can really make a big difference in having a good time during graduate school.
Yes, yeah.
And your research topic is the Greek influence on the birth and early development of monumental Etruscan temples. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, so basically there are these Etruscan monumental temples that start getting built at some point in the 7th or 6th century BC. And those temples seem to not come out of nowhere. Like everywhere, everything comes from somewhere. But before that point, Etruscans were building like religious structures in the form of like huts, which aren't, we can't really verify, but that they were specifically religious. But we do know like they didn't have anything like monumental before a certain point. And then in the 7th and 6th century BC, they start building a lot of temples.
Oh, so very interesting. So you're exploring this shift, or sort of, I mean, from our perspective, sudden shift, but in I guess, devotion or just in general in daily life. So how does the rest of the field of Etruscology view these different cultural influences?
So inside of the field of Etruscology, there's sort of, because it's a newer field in classics and in archaeology, there's sort of a desire to distinguish it from the rest of the Mediterranean and say, hey, this is its own culture. This is not something, like, we can't think of it as just being something that influenced the Romans. We can't think of it as something that was just heavily influenced by the Greek. We have to kind of define who the Etruscans were. So there's an internal battle of, you know, the Etruscans were their own separate, unique culture, and then also they were connected deeply to the Mediterranean trade networks and influenced by all the things there. And so inside of that, I think there is sort of a value in evaluating not only just what influences came to Etruria, but also what influences were exported out of Etruria to the Greek world, to the Phoenician world. Well, a lot of Etruscan scholars wouldn't necessarily disagree with the research that I'm doing. There is sort of a research gap because, like I said, the field's new, and so the people studying Etruscology come from studying ancient Greek civilization, ancient Roman civilization. And so when they go to these sites, they acknowledge a Greek influence, but no comprehensive study of where those influences lie, specifically in temple architecture, has been done. And so there are some smaller articles and things where people talk about it, specifically Dr. Potts and Dr. Winter are huge inspirations for me, because they have done a lot of work in the field that allows me to do what I'm doing now, mm-hmm. essentially. So, yeah.
Oh, very cool. So I guess who were the Etruscans, though, to understand this a bit more?
Yeah, so the Etruscans are a civilization that started in central Italy. Mm-hmm. Their earliest point that we can track them is about the 10th century BC in what we call like the Villanovan culture, which okay. is sort of a subculture of the Etruscans, just classified by archaeologists as, you know, their material culture looks a certain way and mm-hmm. follows a certain standard. And then these Villanovan people live throughout the Tuscan countryside and in like villages and stuff. And like I said, they have a specific religion, which is the same as the Etruscan religion. Of course, it evolves over time, but they have sacred worship places, like I said, the huts, and then also caves and like hills and like places that would seem sacred, like hot springs and stuff. And so we find evidence in those places for some sort of religious activity. And then suddenly, in around the 8th century BC, these villages start to become uninhabited, and the hills around Tuscany, like large plateaus or promontories, start being more inhabited, and we start seeing like villages pop up all over these hills. So that's kind of the birth of Etruscan civilization, like in the archaic period, or what we would call like archaic Etruscan. And so these communities, they start living near each other and they start working together. Now, the decision to live on a hill compared to a flat plain is obviously, you know, like going up and down a hill is a lot of work. And it's like, why would they choose to go on the hills? Well, it's probably some form of like defensive purpose. Like they had to go on the hills because perhaps there was invaders, or they were at war with each other, or, you know, it was just unsafe to be on the ground level. So yeah, they move up these hills, and as these communities start to merge and become closer together, they form what become the Etruscan cities.
Okay. So it's both slow and fast, and kind of the movements that you're tracking over time, right? It's, I guess from our perspective in the contemporary period, things move quickly, but in the past, that's okay. So they're coming together in Tuscany and in various different locations moving together. So what makes an Etruscan temple, what makes that uniquely Etruscan, and who built them? And you touched a little bit on material culture and some work from archaeologists, but what are some of the things that tell you that what you're looking at is an Etruscan temple?
So Etruscan temples are, I mean, they're all rather unique from each other.
Okay.
There is a specific Tuscan type that Vitruvius records. Vitruvius is like a Roman author from much, much later writing about these things. So he's not exactly a good source to know like what actually was going on back then. But he, like he's like 700 or something, 600 years in the future. And so he's writing what he thinks the ideal like Tuscan temple would look like, which he records as like a temple on a podium with columns in the front. And there's a lot of different things that he classifies as that. And specifically, it's the Roman temple that they were building, which, you know, to us would look Greek-inspired, potentially, is what sort of Vitruvius is referring to, because he's trying to say, like, the Etruscans inspired the Romans in some way. And so the Etruscan temples, which stem from about the 7th, 6th century BC, have a lot of different styles. And it seems like they're trying to find kind of their form. Like, you know, in one city, a temple will look completely different than in another city. And so there's not, like with Greek architecture, by a certain point, the Greeks have specific like standards of like styles, like Doric, Corinthian, Ionic. There's certain ways that they have to build their temples, and they have all the measurements down. And the Etruscans don't quite have that, or at least not that we can see. Yeah.
So they're sort of finding out their style, I guess. And who is building these then? Like, is it the village themselves? Like, is it different communities coming together? Who do you think were building these temples?
Yeah. So that's I guess the big research question of my thesis is who is building these temples, or who inspired them, and was it potentially a Greek migrant worker, like an architect that came to Etruria? Or did these Etrurian architects or Etruscan architects work with the Greeks and maybe learn from them? Because that seems to be the case in some examples. But we do know, like, specifically for who's funding them and how are they getting built, we do know we have one really, really incredible example from Pyrgi, which was a port city of another, a large Etruscan city called Caere. And Pyrgi has, there was a big excavation that happened there in the 60s, and they found a lot of stuff. They found two monumental temples, and they found as well in a deposit there, these tablets, and written on them, there's Phoenician script and also Greek, I believe. And they have basically who built the temple, which was a Etruscan king or a Kyritan king, and they have the god that the temple is dedicated to, and in the corners of the tablets are holes, which would suggest that it was nailed somewhere for everyone to see. Some scholars theorize that it was potentially nailed to the door of the temple, which is unusual because in the case of Greek temples, the people that built them or funded them, they didn't put their names on the temples. There are a few examples where names are on temples, like the architects, for example, in Syracuse put their name on the stereobate of the temple on the very like bottom, like almost where no one would see it. But on this Etruscan temple, in the plain view of everyone, you have this plaque that basically would have said, this is who built this temple, presumably. And so that's one example, an Etruscan king building it. And then there are a few other examples, like in Rome, for example, presumably they have a lot of temples being built in the 6th century, and we assume that it would have been the kings of Rome that were building these temples. And so in all the cases that we have where we know or where we might know who built these temples, I mean, in Pyrgi we definitely know because it comes from a very primary source, but it seems to be like some sort of upper class, like aristocracy trying to, with some sort of political motivation, like trying to prove their authority or trying to gain legitimacy through piety.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting that you have very ancient types of receipts almost.
Yeah. it's not awesome quite... they recorded it. Yes. Yeah.
That's nice. And it's interesting that depending on the culture of the architect or the period that it's these ancient sites are being built in, there's a different degrees of humility of how you sign or ascribe, maybe not ownership, but creation to different types of temples. So that's very interesting that you're able to find at least one really clear example to start, and that allows you to extrapolate on other temples as well. And you mentioned that this one piece of evidence has Phoenician script and Greek script. So were the Etruscans influenced by these other cultures that they were interacting with?
Yeah, so I would say the obvious answer, I guess, to me is absolutely they were. Yeah. In many other ways, specifically, starting from the 8th or 7th century BC, as these Etruscan cities start to form on the hills and they start to grow their power and influence from there, they become connected to the sort of Mediterranean trade network that is growing at the time, which is dominated by the Phoenicians and the Greeks. And the Greeks are colonizing southern Italy and Sicily, and the Phoenicians are colonizing Sicily and Sardinia and places around the Mediterranean. And so Etruria is sort of tapping into this network that's growing. And Etruria was rather rich at this time. Okay. And I believe partially because they tapped into this network and they brought their own unique things into it. And so the Greeks bring to Etruria various types of pottery that we can find, and also stories and myths too. So the Etrurians adapt, or the Etruscans adapt, certain aspects of Greek culture that we can see. For example, on almost every Etruscan temple that I can think of, there are depictions of Heracles.
Okay.
And the Etruscan gods were once formless, kind of. They didn't have a specific way that they looked like or were represented in art. And then after this Greek influence starts to come in and they start seeing depictions of Greek gods or goddesses on Greek art, they start depicting their own gods and goddesses based on those Greek gods.
Interesting.
So it's a process called anthropomorphizing. And so they anthropomorphize their deities based on the Greek model, essentially. And so certain gods, like Apulu, which is an Etruscan god that's adapted from Greek, and we actually have a statue of Apulu from Vey. That god gets a physical form and is represented in a certain way. And then there's Uni, which is the equivalent to Hera, and she also gets physical representations. And again, it sort of seems to be based on a Greek inspiration.
Well, that's a huge amount of influence and exchange, right? To shift your religious understanding or the boundaries around your deities to have those take a different form than they may have in the past. That sounds like a lot of influence. So are there other visible influences in Etruscan temples as they are sites of worship? Like are there foreign influences visible on the temples you look at?
Yeah, there definitely are, I would say, in terms of like the fact that first of all, they're building these monumental temples when there isn't evidence beforehand seems to suggest that they were inspired to in some way. I mean, it could be that they urbanized and since they're no longer in the countryside, they need a place to worship like nearby, you know, like to not have to go down from the hill and then go to like some sacred cave or something. They needed a place to worship that was nearby. But it also seems potentially that there is sort of a political or communal purpose in the temples of these, like I said, multiple settlements moving onto hilltops and living together and growing into cities. Maybe they needed a communal space where they could all come together, and the temples offered a good opportunity for that. But the architecture of the temples themselves is rather interesting because they use a lot of Greek conventions of temple building, depending on the example, but a lot of them use columns and have what is called a cella or a cella, which is the central room of the temple. So it's divided. The temple is divided in two parts. And in one example, which again, it comes from Pyrgi, which is the best excavated temples in the Etruscan world right now. It's at Pyrgi. The temple B seems to have a lot of Greek influence, almost to the point where you wonder how they would have done that without having a Greek person, a Greek architect there, or without the Etruscan architects studying in a Greek city or something, or learning from another architect, because it's one thing to use columns and have like the same roof designs and stuff, and it's another thing to use the same measurement. And so they use attic feet to measure the entire temple, and it's been like measured in this way and studied to find that from the archaeologists that worked on the site. And so I think it's 99x67 or something attic feet, and so that's significant because it suggests that there would have been someone there helping them, or there would have been a significant influence, and not something that you can go to a Greek city and look at a Greek temple and see it and decide, I want to make something like that. You know, you need to know something more.
So almost like a sharing of blueprints and sharing of training or intellectual tradition from architecture. Because you're right, you could walk to another city and look at something and say, oh, that's beautiful. But to recreate it to such precision, it suggests some close collaboration. So you mentioned Pyrgi as one of the sites where you gain a lot of this evidence. But what are some other sources or types of evidence that you use in your work to understand these temples?
Yeah, so there are pretty limited literary sources, I would say. There's certain Roman scholars that describe Etruscan temples later on. Again, it's something we can't exactly say is like a one-to-one. And then there's Livy, for example, who he records the dates of temples, like when they were built. And he's been pretty accurate to the archaeology.
Okay.
So that's interesting, you know, like within like a margin of a couple years to where the archaeology would date it. But outside of Pyrgi, there's again Kyrie, who is influencing Pyrgi, and there's temples being built there. And actually, Queens does an excavation at Kyrie,
excavating
one of the temples, which I went to last summer. And so I excavated there, and I got to see the temple become slowly uncovered, and I found it very fascinating.
That is super cool, yeah.
Yeah, which is why I decided to study this in the first place. And in seeing that, I also found, when I was digging there, a lot of Greek pottery was being found like throughout the entire temple. And the roof tiles and the terracottas and stuff that were found there were supposedly built by Greek craftsmen. And so there seems to have been, at least on the ground, seeing the archaeology, a lot of Greek influence. And not that the Etruscans were just taking things from Greece and planting them in their own land, their own cities, and just taking them one-to-one. But they were adopting Greek artifacts and adopting Greek ways of life and things like the Symposium and adapting them to Etruscan culture. So it's not a one-to-one. You couldn't put a Greek temple beside an Etruscan temple and not know the difference. You would obviously know which one is which because they have quite a distinct difference. But it's more so in the way that you can clearly also tell that there is something going on there where the Etruscans are looking at Greek things and finding inspiration in them and adapting them to their own culture.
Oh, that's really cool, this type of ancient cultural exchange. That it's to me, at least, it's very interesting to see how communities and cultures in the ancient world do some of the same things that, you know, as modern peoples, we do as well. We look at cultures near us and we take what we like, we change it a little bit, we make it our own.
Yeah.
And then sometimes we give stuff back and vice versa. Like it's a back and forth between different cultures. So it's very cool to know that, you know, ancient peoples were doing the exact same things in their very important religious sites as well. And how was getting to be at a temple site doing the excavation? You said it was awesome, but or I took that it was awesome, but what does a day-to-day look like when you are excavating a site? Do 2 days look the same? Are they very different? What is it? Can you tell us more about that?
I mean, every day could look the same depending on what you're doing, or could look very different. Mm. For me, I was excavating a specific room. Mm. So I'd wake up at like 6 a.m., 7 a.m. in Italy. We had a villa and in the Tuscan countryside. And so we wake up, we get ready. I would essentially wake up and I had these pieces of dried meat that I got from a local butcher, and I would eat that. And then I'd throw my shoes and start and go to the dig like straight away. I would just wake up excited to go. Mm-hmm. And then when we got there, you know, fill up your water, put on sunscreen, that sort of thing. It's very hot,
yes,
very dusty.
Imagine.
And every single day it's sort of exciting to see what we're going to uncover. And mm-hmm. I've worked a lot of jobs before, like in like kitchens and that sort of thing. And although I like the rush of it, it was something else to work a job where the inspiration to do the work comes from within. I was not being forced to do any of this work. I could have probably sat around all day and the supervisor would not have forced me to do something. Mm-hmm. But because of my own like inspiration to uncover these things, I would spend most of my day in my little room, digging away, even in the hot sun, you know. And it was very inspiring for me. Mm. Yeah.
Will you get to go back this summer? Are there plans to head back? Or,
well, I've been debating it. Mm-hmm. For the most part, right now, my focus is to get as much done as my research project as possible.
Of course, yeah.
And Dr. Kolovicki, who is running the dig, is also my supervisor. So he's also encouraging me to, okay, focus on the major research project first, and then we'll see where you're at and judge from there. So,
oh, well, fingers crossed that both work out well, right?
Yeah.
That lots of progress happens on the research project side.
Yeah.
That also allows you to continue visiting the site this coming summer.
Yeah, and especially given what I'm researching for my MRP, I feel sort of driven to go back because I'm researching Etruscan temples, and I know so much more than I did last summer. And so I feel like I have something to bring to the excavation and some perspective to bring as well. So I would, you know, love to go back.
Yeah. I mean, beyond the really cool research that you're getting to do, a summer in the Tuscan countryside sounds pretty nice as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in addition to all of this work that you're doing, academic research, archaeological work, I know you're also, I hear you're quite involved with Ceres. And can you tell us a little bit more about what Ceres is and your role in it this year?
Yeah, so Ceres is a graduate journal that was started a couple years back by some graduate students in the classics department. And essentially, it is a place for graduate students to submit their essays and their articles. And then we have an editing team that we assemble, and they work with the authors of these papers to refine them. And we have a team of artists who also works with them to create, you know, like a little depiction to put in the journal for their article. And by the end of March, we print them. And so in early April-ish is when we're going to have a conference and the authors will come up and they'll speak a little bit about their entry in the journal, and we'll have the journals there for people to purchase as well.
Oh, very cool. And can folks who are not in classics come to the conference as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There is a Instagram account for Ceres called Ceres Queens. That's Ceres Queens. And basically on there is where we're going to post all the information about the conference, when it's upcoming. Right now we don't have a date nailed down, so it's going to be something in the future. So keep your eyes out if you're if you're into this sort of stuff.
Well, it'll be very cool to learn more about work that you've done, but that other colleagues are doing as well. And I think classics is so interesting as someone who's much more a modern historian. Classics is so interesting because it's such an interdisciplinary approach to how you use evidence. So that's so interesting that your journal also takes a more interdisciplinary approach, having, you know, artists to support the research that people are doing to show what people are talking about and the pieces they're working with, the material culture, the sites they're working with, those types of things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that's very right. exciting for yeah. the authors to have that opportunity.
Yeah, no, that's great that you're continuing to publish this. And are you publishing anything in it this year, or are you mostly working on the behind-the-scenes side this year?
Yeah, I don't think it would be appropriate, I guess, fair for enough. Me to publish in it, just because I'm a co-chief editor mm-hmm. on it, so... But I would if I wasn't.
You Fair know, enough, yes.
Maybe next year.
Next year, yes. Yeah. I also hear that you enjoy cooking. What are some cuisines or dishes that you like to cook a lot?
Yeah, so, I mean, I cook everything. Like, okay. I will learn anything. I worked, as I said, in kitchens mm-hmm. for a time, and I also worked on movie sets.
Oh, very cool.
In Winnipeg, serving famous people and stuff. And so that was, you know, I had to learn how to cook a lot of different things. And then at home, it's like there's sort of this battle of like, oh, should I eat out or should I, you know, make food? And for me, like, I mean, I love making food. So the answer can be pretty simple depending on, you know, how expensive it is. Mm-hmm. I like Italian food and Chinese and Japanese food and all sorts of things, really.
Is there a favorite dish that's having a moment in your house right now?
I really like beef stews, honestly. Maybe it's because of the winter, but I think they're comforting and they're sort of simple in a nice way, and they're very satiating.
Mm-hmm. Nice and hearty and savory, for especially with all this cold weather we've been having. This winter has been like exceptionally cold, it feels like. that's very nice. So I know you mentioned when you were in Tuscan, you were eating a lot of dried meat in the morning, but did you have a chance to try different Tuscan cooking while you were on site?
Yeah. We were staying in like a small village or a small town called Treveteri, which is essentially means like New Kyre or something like that. So it's named after Kyre anyways. And there wasn't like there wasn't a lot of options.
It's very small. There.
So we tried, you know, different foods. Like I would try different foods every day and I would actually rank them on my little list that I had for like the restaurant we were going to every day. But when I left the dig, I traveled around Italy for a little while. And at that point I got to try a lot of different Italian cuisine across the central and southern part of the country.
And can I ask if you have a favorite dish? I know that's hard but across all those different regional cuisines. But what would your favorite dish from your travels be?
I mean, I went to Italy when I was 17. And I had their like, it's so simple, but the margherita pizza I absolutely loved. Like, I loved the stretchiness of the dough and the flavor of the sauce and everything. It was so simple. And I mean, that's at the heart of Italian cooking. Like, that's what it is simplicity. And so I had that pizza, and I was just like, man, this is the best pizza I've ever had. And it felt healthy, and it didn't feel bad to eat afterwards. So I would say maybe it's that.
Oh, well, that is true. It's hard to beat a classic and pizza. Well, Joshua, thank you so much. It has been great chatting with you. Thanks for doing the show, and best of luck with the rest of your research.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And we'd love to have you back if you want to tell us more about digs in the future or how your major research project goes.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.